reason why women should have the vote are obvious to every fair minded person. We have waited too long for political justice. We refuse to wait any longer.
This is no simple reform. It really is a revolution.
An inclusive and intersectional feminism that calls upon all of us to join the resistance to racism, to Islamophobia, to anti-Semitism, to misogyny, to capitalist exploitation.
And our pussies ain't for grabbing.
Hello, and welcome to the Same Shit, Different Century podcast. My name is Amy Trend, and I am here with
Hannah Monkley
and Amy Toll.
And today's episode is on a brilliant suffragette called Lillian Lenton. If you listen to our podcast, she's somebody that we have mentioned time and time again because she always seems to be in the middle of everything. So Lillian Lenton was a suffragette from Leicester. And she
L's going on there. Yeah.
Lillian Lenton from Leicester. I don't know what else I can add to that to make it a tongue twister.
Lovely Lillian Lenton.
Lillian Lenton from Leicester.
Lighting fires.
Anyway, so she's one of my favourite suffragettes just because she's just such a character. But sadly, she's somebody that I'd never even heard of until this year when we started researching this podcast. So like, as I said, her name just keeps popping up again and again and again, which is quite incredible because she actually only was a suffragette for 2 years, really.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then as a statue has been erected this year of another Leicester suffragette, Alice Hawkins, Lenton's story seems to have fallen by the wayside and she doesn't ever seem to be talked about too much. So
she's a pyromaniac.
Yeah, which is probably why, because she was, well, yeah, controversial.
Yeah.
So Lillian, or Lily Ida Lenton, was born in Leicester in 1891 to Isaac Lenton, a carpenter, and Mahala Lenton, a housewife. She was the eldest of five children. On leaving school, she trained to be a dancer. During this time, she heard a speech by Emmeline Pankhurst and later recalled in a 1961 interview that she made up my mind that night as soon as I was 21 and my own boss and made it through these examinations, I would volunteer. True to her word, in 1912, as soon as she turned 21, she joined the WSPU and went on to become one of the suffragettes movement's most prolific and daring arsonists. She was also pivotal in the government creating the Cat and Mouse Act. Lillian's notoriety was such that if you type her name into the British newspaper archive, it produces almost 290 articles on her, which is quite incredible for, you know, 2 years of setting fire to things. Less than 2 months after her 21st birthday, Lillian took part in the mass window smashing campaign in the West End in March 1912. She targeted government offices in Whitehall alongside Rosa May Billinghurst, who had agreed to hide the stones that they used under the rug covering her legs. Lillian was one of the 200 suffragettes who were arrested that day and was imprisoned for taking part in the demonstration. She was found guilty and sentenced to 2 months in Holloway Prison under the alias Ida Inkley. This was one of the several aliases she used. She actually appears on the Roll of Honour of suffragette prisoners twice, once as Lillian and once as Ida. I wonder how often that happened, that people registered twice.
Loads, I think.
Yeah.
It just reminded me, I meant to say it before, have you come across that they called them the, was it in the newspaper, they called themselves the Hollowayettes or something like that?
Oh, I definitely have seen Hollowayettes written down somewhere. That's great. We could be Hollowayettes.
We could be.
Not that we've been to prison, but we work on Holloway Road.
We're
like Holloway crew.
Yeah.
After leaving prison, she straight away joined the campaign to destroy the contents of pillar boxes, as we talked about a bit more in detail in the last episode. She often worked alongside May Billinghurst. By December 1912, the government claimed that over 5,000 letters had been destroyed by the WSPU. However, she had much bigger plans of arson in mind, and she later stated, "I was at the suffragette headquarters and announced that I didn't want to break any more windows, but I did want to burn some buildings. And I was told that a girl named Olive Worry had just been saying the same thing. What are the chances?" So we two met and the real serious fires in this country started. So I think she was kind of quite pivotal in this kind of introduction of this burning building strategy.
How many of the suffragettes actually did burn houses down? I would think there'd be only a few people that would do it.
Yeah,
it's definitely quite, extreme.
And as we mentioned before as well, it was, around this time when they really started to up their militancy that a lot of suffragettes even started to leave the WSPU because it got a bit too much for them. It was just the real, the hardcore few that remained. The leaders of the WSPU wholeheartedly encouraged this escalation of militancy. The aim was to attack property in the hope that the insurance companies would bring pressure on the government to give women the vote. Over the next 2 years, suffragettes burned hundreds of buildings across the country, trying to target high-profile properties such as mansions, railway stations, castles, and even churches. Lillian's first arrest for arson came in February 1913. Around 3 a.m. on the 20th of February 1913, Lillian and Olive Worry set fire to the Tea Pavilion in Kew Gardens, burning it to the ground. And we put a picture of this on our Instagram after our last episode. To do this, they'd had to scale what the police considered to be an unclimbable fence. The fire brigade fought the flames for 2 hours, but the building and its contents were destroyed. Lillian and Olive left behind 4 cards signed to voteless women, which made it clear that this was a politically motivated attack. One read, "Remember, no property will be safe until women are enfranchised. You will have to give in, so be sensible and do so at once." Another said, "You can put out a fire, but you cannot put out the militant spirit of women." The two women were pursued by the police across Richmond Cricket Ground before being captured and arrested. They gave their names as Lillian Lenton and Joyce Locke. In court, it was reported that the constables gave chase, and just before they caught them, each of the women was seen to throw away a portmanteau. In one of the bags, which the women threw away, were found a hammer, a saw, a bundle of tow, and I've looked at what tow is, and I think it is just rope.
Oh. Yeah, I suppose like towing.
Tow rope.
Yeah, not human toes.
No. T-O-W.
No, that wouldn't be that funny, but that
no.
Strongly smelling of paraffin, and some paper smelling strongly of tar. Later that day, Lillian and Olive were charged at Richmond Police Court and held in custody for a week. After their bail was refused, one of them threw a book and some papers from the clerk's table at the chairman of the bench. They were taken directly from court to Holloway Prison, where Lillian's conduct was recorded in the prison's daily record as bad, very defiant. She smashed everything in the cell she was first placed in and was removed to a special strong cell. She was kept apart from other prisoners, not allowed to communicate, and all privileges were suspended. And now I've got a transcript of this prison report that's mentioned. And so it's from the 20th of February 1913. And it says that she was in there for setting fire to a building at Richmond. And then it also said that she'd been in prison before but refuses to give any particulars. So she was being as difficult, as she possibly could.
Good on her.
It said that she refuses medical examination and she is rather thin, bad, very defiant. And then in the special notes at the end, it says, "Recognised by officers as having been in prison before, but name cannot be given. Has taken no food since reception, smashed up everything in the cell she was first placed in, removed to a special strong cell, kept apart from all other prisoners and not allowed to communicate, all privileges suspended. It was during this stint in prison that she first went on a hunger strike. After 2 days of striking, she was then forcibly and violently force-fed. She was strapped into a chair and held down by up to 7 prison wardens. 2 doctors fed a tube up her nostril and down her throat. Some food accidentally entered her lungs and she became critically ill with pleurisy. Fearing she would die in prison, the authorities contacted the Home Secretary, Reginald McKenna, who authorised her release. Lillian was carried from prison on a chair and taken by a taxi to a friend's house, where she was treated by suffragette sympathiser Charles Mansell Moulin for septic pneumonia and pleurisy. Her case was widely covered by the media and created an outrage among the public, worsened by the fact that Reginald McKenna, the Home Secretary, denied that she had been force-fed and that her illness was actually caused by her hunger strike. However, Home Office papers showed that she was definitely force-fed on the 23rd of February 1913.
Yeah, of course she was.
So it's just a flat-out lie that he said, no, she wasn't force-fed, she's ill because she was hunger-striking.
Mm.
But the evidence was there to say, like, you know, you're chatting crap.
Yeah.
Of course she was. So that got him in a lot of trouble.
Good.
And the government in a lot of trouble. A letter to the Times in 1913 from Victor Horsley, a leading surgeon, claimed the Home Secretary's attempted denial that Miss Lenton was nearly killed by the forcible feeding is worthless. She was tied into a chair and her head dragged backward across the back of the chair by her hair. The tube was forced through the nose twice. After the second introduction, when the food was poured in, it caused violent choking. She was resultantly released from prison to avoid any further embarrassment to the government and also to prevent any chances that she may become a martyr for the cause. To avoid more such political embarrassment, the government rushed through its temporary discharge bill, aka the Cat and Mouse Act, in April 1913, which stated that hunger-striking suffragettes who became critically weak could be released on temporary licence to recover their health, and when the security forces could then rearrest them. So, however, Lillian wasn't an easy mouse to catch. Like, they brought this on themselves.
Mm.
She was too ill to attend her next court hearing on the 27th of February 1913. And then she disappeared from London and went on the run from the police, travelling the country, setting fire to buildings and burning votes for women into golf greens and cricket pitches.
I love that. I think that's so cool.
It's so good. They always seem to target golf and cricket.
Yeah.
It's like the ultimate symbol of kind of
boys club
masculinity.
The patriarchy.
Yeah. I mean, golf clubs are still, women can't be members of,
yeah,
them, can't they?
Some of them.
So, I can't say with any authority.
I think there is, I definitely know one in Scotland.
Yeah, it's like the whole gentleman's club.
I used to play golf with me dad.
Did you?
I wasn't very good.
I played crazy golf.
I'm awesome at
but
crazy
I like
golf.
That. You're really good at golf.
Crazy golf.
Oh, crazy golf. There's that scene, you know, we were saying about in Parade's End, where it's based, obviously, on,
yeah,
the attack of, is it Asquith?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And the suffragette in that, like, runs onto the golf course, her and her friend.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen
that? I have seen that, but when it was on TV.
Yeah,
it's
on Netflix, I watched it again.
It's a great film.
I find it quite funny when they, like, rip off her friends, this is just completely going off topic, but they grab her friend by the arm and they like rip her whole sleeve off, which is like,
but no, but they did that happened,
really?
Yeah, yeah. Well,
they tried to rip his clothes off.
They tried to rip his clothes off, so they responded in
they
kind.
Rip her, oh okay, but they, it just looks like a little, would you, if you pulled someone's arm with their whole sleeve rip off, like,
there's only one way to find out.
Stay away from my blouse.
It just looks a bit comedy, that's,
yeah, I have, no, to rewatch it. She reappeared again in June in Doncaster, where she had been arrested with Harry Johnson, an 18-year-old trainee journalist. Harry was a frequent... So how old was she? She was 22.
Well,
4 year age gap. Harry was a frequent visitor to the Suffragette Safe House in Osborne Road, where Lillian was staying. Now, I was trying to remember, you know, the Suffragette graphic novel that you've got?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember? I swear there's like one of them, the main person in that meets a young boy and they set fire to things together.
How did she meet him? God, I can't remember now. But
I was wondering if that was kind of based on Lillian.
I think
Lillian,
like,
and
there
Harry.
Are a lot of things that are obviously based on
they've picked up little
people.
Bits from
yeah,
people.
But it's a fictional character, which
Sally
is
Heathcott.
Sally Heathcott, yeah.
The pair, armed with newspapers, a 2-gallon tin of paraffin, cotton wool and fire lighters, had broken into Westfield House, except it wasn't as empty as it had appeared. The pair disturbed the 72-year-old housekeeper and they told her their plans, and then they left, stashing the evidence. Police found the hoard the next morning, and the name of the safe house owner, allegedly, was sat squarely atop a newspaper. I'm wondering if this is the housekeeper that kind of dobbed them in by putting the name on top. A warrant was issued for Harry's arrest, and the safe house servant, Augusta Winship, was put into custody. So Lillian wasn't kind of even associated with this. They just thought because the name of the safe house was there that they would arrest Augusta. The pair appeared in a packed courtroom at Leeds Assizes. It was then Augusta's defence lawyer, called one May Dennis, aka Lillian Lenton, to stand up. She took the stand and confessed it was she and not Augusta at the house. Sporadic clapping and gasps rippled from the room's packed benches. She was asked why she had entered the house. "To burn it," she replied. A near comical gasp of "ooh" came from the public gallery. As a measure of Lillian's notoriety, a photographer and reporter from the Daily Mirror were covering the case. The Mirror's headline on June the 11th, 1913, read, "Caught at last, Lillian Lenton is sent for trial," because like this whole time she's been on the run. She's constantly on the run, this woman. Harry pleaded not guilty. "I do not plead..." And then Lillian said, "I do not plead either guilty or not guilty. I do not recognise the court."
Ooh, burn.
Yeah. After trial at Leeds Assizes, Harry was sentenced to 12 months hard labour, and Lily was sent to Leeds prison to await sentence. She told the police that she would go on hunger strike, be released, abscond and carry on arson until the government was brought to its knees.
Brilliant.
She's so great. She went on hunger strike and was released on licence on the 17th of June 1913, as she said she would be, to the house of a suffragette sympathiser in Westfield Terrace in Leeds. Although the police were watching the house, she managed to escape by switching places with another suffragette who had come to the house in a van dressed as a delivery boy. Lillian went on the run again, initially in Harrogate, then in Scarborough. Here she adopted the disguise of a children's nurse carrying the baby son of a fellow WSP member. So she borrowed this baby and disguised herself as a children's nurse.
That's brilliant.
A policeman helpfully opened a taxi door for her as she hid behind the baby so that she wouldn't be recognised. And she then escaped to France in a private yacht. She's just like the plot of a movie.
Yeah,
like
a James Bond film. Yeah.
The Criminal Record Office issued a surveillance photograph of her taken secretly in the exercise yard of Holloway Prison, in the accompanying details of which she is described as being 5'2" tall, with brown eyes and hair. It was circulated to all police forces around, well, England, I think, at this point. Lenton later stated, "Whenever I was out of prison, my object was to burn 2 buildings a week. The object was to create an absolutely impossible condition of affairs in the country, to prove it was impossible to govern without the consent of the governed." Now, I love this quote because I think it just perfectly sums up suffragettes. Like, we are going to create havoc because why should we listen to your laws when we have no say in them?
I thought, I know you probably said this last time, but I thought the part of the point with burning property was that was part of the, to do with how you could have the vote, free property.
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly.
No one could ignore arson, nor could they ignore young women who went about saying what I said, that whenever we saw an empty building, we would burn it. And as I say, after that, I did burn an empty building whenever I saw one. So she, you know, she stuck wasn't all talk, she stuck to it.
Deeds, not words.
Exactly. On returning to Britain, she continued setting fire to buildings. On one occasion, you kind of said this story last week, but I'll mention it anyway, just in case somebody's listening to just this, because they're interested about her. On returning to Britain, she continued setting fire to buildings. On one occasion, she was given two bombs by a young male sympathiser of the movement. When the woman that she was staying with near Edinburgh heard about the bombs, she insisted that Lillian get rid of them in a lake on the estate of a friend. Lillian went to Edinburgh with the two bombs in an attaché case. She asked a policeman for directions. He said he was just coming off duty and offered to show her the way to the tram. Lillian assumed that he had recognised her because everybody, like all the police, had her photo and she was like right up there on their most wanted. She assumed that he would recognise her and take her to the police station, but instead he took her to the tram. Amazing. To her amusement, he even carried the bomb-filled attaché case for her. She was nearly caught by the police in Cardiff, but then escaped dressed as an infirm old lady and got on the train to London. Like, she is just... what's she been?
Disguises.
She's been a delivery boy, a children's nurse, an infirm old lady.
Is that the one where they sneaked someone in as a delivery boy and then she switched clothes and she went out?
So I think somebody arrived and they had, like, a trunk with them. So I think there must have been more clothes or something in the trunk.
Yeah.
And then they switched over and then I guess they both left somehow.
Oh, I see, yeah.
And then she changed at some point to be a children's nurse and borrowed a baby, carried on the rest of her journey.
What happened to the baby?
I don't know. I hope they met up at some point and gave the baby back to its mother. And then, and so it continues. Who knows what else she's been that we don't know about?
Yeah.
There's more as well. In October 1913, she was arrested while collecting a bicycle from left luggage office at Paddington Station. Miss Lillian Lenton again in court was the headline in the Yorkshire Post and Leeds Intelligencer. Miss Lillian Lenton, who escaped from Leeds disguised as a grocer's boy, was rearrested at Paddington Station on Tuesday, was again charged at the Richmond Police Court yesterday with setting fire to the Tea Pavilion at Kew Gardens on February the 20th. So, finally in October, they've finally managed to get hold of her and have put her in prison again for this crime that she committed in February. While on remand, she went on hunger strike and a thirst strike for which again she was forcibly fed, her physical health again being seriously affected by this treatment. She was released on licence for 5 days into the care of Mrs. Diplock of London. The police again keeping a very watchful eye on her, like a seriously watchful eye on her this time. Once again, she managed to escape from the nursing home and was arrested on the 22nd of December 1913 and was charged with setting fire to a mansion in Cheltenham. This time she was recognised from her police surveillance photo and imprisoned when she commenced yet another hunger strike and thirst strike and was released on Christmas Day to a house in King's Norton. And once again, she escaped from under the noses of the watching police. So whenever she went into these houses, safe houses, they just watched the doors.
Not very well.
Not very well.
I mean,
it's quite American, but I've just got this image of these cops sitting there with a donut, like, chatting, and then being like, she's gone.
Yeah, the equivalent of an Eccles cake or something.
Yeah.
Oh, she's not here.
In March 1914, she made a flying visit to Doncaster WSPU, dressed as a dapper young man, complete with a moustache, cane and Homburg hat. She continued to evade the police until the 4th of May 1914, when she was arrested in Birkenhead, held on remand and awaiting trial at the Leeds Assizes for the arson committed at Doncaster. She again went on hunger and thirst strike until she was released on the 12th of May 1914. As the papers speculated about whether she would escape again, the police mounted an extremely close watch on this Harrogate address.
Yeah, whatever.
Car lamps were trained on the front and back of the house during the hours of darkness, and everyone entering and leaving the house was scrutinised. Nevertheless, when the police entered the house to rearrest Lillian at the end of her licence period, she was nowhere to be found. So stupid. The police's theory, this is great, was that she had escaped among a group of veiled women who had left the house together the previous Saturday and then scattered around the moor.
There's not anything where they think, like, oh, someone's going in with a big box, or there's a group of women with veils
covering their faces. Maybe we should check and see if one of them is Lillian. I've just got... Have you seen the Thomas Crown Affair?
No.
You know, when they were wearing... So they robbed the art gallery... And they're all wearing bowler hats with briefcases.
Oh, okay.
And the police are watching them like, I don't know which one. It's Thomas Crown. Like, who's doing this? And then there's, like, really good music in the background. I've got this image of, like, all these women in veils coming out and scattering. And this music playing. Okay. And they're kind of crisscrossing.
Is this, like, is there two versions of that?
Yeah, I'm talking about the Pierce Brosnan version.
I always thought that wouldn't be very good, but maybe it is.
It's not, apart from the last 5 minutes.
Okay, right.
Because of the frequency of her escapes, Lenton became known as the Tiny Wily Elusive Pimpernel. So I have a transcript of a letter from the Chief Constable of Leeds to the Home Office on the 4th of July 1913. So again, like, at this point, she'd been on the run for 2 months after this whole veiled woman escape. Dear Sir, Lillian Lenton or May Dennis, I shall be glad to know whether you have been able to trace the whereabouts of this prisoner. It is, of course, very desirable that her rearrest should be effected before the opening of Leeds Assizes on the 12th of this month. In your letter of the 12th, dated last month, you mentioned that she is said to have gone to Scotland. It is not unlikely that she has taken part in the burning of Ballochinrain Castle or Leuchars Junction Station, or at least is associated with the persons concerned in one or other of those outrages. Have you considered the advisability of circulating her description and photograph to the Scottish police? I have asked the Metropolitan Police to supply you with the photographs they have of her, and I have instructed the Governor of Leeds Prison to give you copies of any photographs that were taken in the prison upon your asking for them. Yours truly, the Chief Constable, City Police, Leeds. So while she was on the run this time, on the 4th of August 1914, England declared war on Germany. 2 days later, the NUWSS announced that it was suspending all political activity until the war was over. The leadership of the WSPU began negotiating with the British government. On the 10th of August, the government announced it was releasing all suffragettes from prison. In return, the WSPU agreed to end their militant activities and help with the war effort. So at this point, she's no longer on the run. They're all released. During this time, women worked in jobs traditionally done by men, proving that they could do them just as well. Lillian, like so many young women, played her part. She ended up serving as a medical orderly in Serbia with the Scottish Women's Hospital Unit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I just read about that in that book that's more about the NUWSS. It's actually really fascinating.
Yeah. Like, so I had
really amazing.
I did have lots more to say about this, but I thought I was going off point and there was loads that Elizabeth Crawford had written about it that was really, really interesting.
Oh, okay.
So maybe that's for another time. I think
this is the Jane Robinson book, the Hearts and Minds one that came out this year. And it's just incredible, like, what they did. And, there's I think the woman that set it up is, like, the sort of has the highest honours, like, was rewarded the highest honours after the war. But she actually died, I think, from... So she was still... I think this might have been in... They were in France, but I think she had cancer and she was dying while she was there, and they got back to like Newcastle somewhere and she died.
Oh, we should definitely do some wartime suffragette
stories. It's really interesting because they all did such amazing they were so brave.
The Boer War as well, there's some pretty cool feminist stories to do with that as well.
Oh, it's just so much to cover. There's so many interesting things. Her courage and ability were recognised with a French Red Cross medal. After the war, the Representation of the People Act in 1918 was passed, awarding the vote to women over the age of 30 who were householders, the wives of householders, occupiers of property with an annual rent of £5, or graduates of British universities. Lenton was unimpressed by this concession, later relating in the 1961 BBC documentary, "Personally, I didn't vote for a very long time because I hadn't either a husband or furniture, although I was over 30. She turned 30 in 1921. So she was very unimpressed with this Representation of the People's Act, or as she would be, and kind of continued, I think she continued doing what she, obviously not setting fire to buildings, but I think she actively...
Is that... Sorry.
No, carry on.
No, I was just... I feel like I interrupted you. But the BBC documentary, is that the thing you had a recording of, like part of it?
Yeah.
I think this is the one that you found on your phone. There's like a little... Oh, no, do you mean the film? No, that's the... So I go on... I think I go on to speak about what that is. Yeah, I've mentioned that in a bit as well. This is like a little BBC clip of her.
Okay.
To like an interview. It is on, it's on the sound archives. Where am I? Okay, so after the Russian Revolution, she travelled in Russia with fellow suffragette Nina Boyle. Lenton later worked in the British Embassy in Stockholm. She was a speaker for the Save the Children Fund, and from 1924 to 1933, she was a speaker and travel organiser for the Women's Freedom League, as well as the editor of the League's bulletin for over 11 years. After working in Scotland in animal welfare, she's just like a saint.
Yeah.
Lenton became the financial secretary of the National Union of Women's Teachers until 1953. I just mean, what a woman. So yeah, she's
never stopped.
She's been working in hospitals, she's been doing animal welfare, she's been helping teachers, she's been fighting for the vote, she's part of the Save the Children Fund. Like,
brilliant.
She's living her life to the full and doing as much as she can
to
make the world a better place. Women were finally given equal voting rights to men, including lowering the voting age to 21 by the Representation of the People Equal Franchise Act in 1928 when she was 37. So she was so young to compared to a lot of the people that you read about.
Yeah.
Just before the First World War, so I don't know the relevance of this particularly, but everything I read mentioned it, so I feel like I should mention it. Just before the First World War, Lenton met author D.H. Lawrence when she fled from the police and escaped to the Lake District. He was introduced to her as a man who's only got one subject, and that's sex.
Ooh.
So I can't really find out any more details about, like, their relationship. Like, did they become friends or anything when they were in the Lake District together? Was it like...
Did they do it?
I just don't know.
Let's assume yes.
Let's assume they became lovers.
D.H. Lawrence novels.
She became his muse. So, In 1955, so this is the little film that I showed on YouTube. I think it's just called The Suffragette Reunion or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In 1955, she appeared with other former suffragettes in a BBC News broadcast beside the statue of Mrs. Pankhurst to mark the 37th anniversary of women getting the vote. She was again filmed in 1959. No, this is it. Oh, no. Oh, no. It's in the 50s sometime. She was again filmed in 1959 when she discussed the Cat and Mouse Act. This item was broadcast in January 1960. Finally, she was interviewed for BBC News in October 1961 when she discussed her meeting with D.H. Lawrence.
Ooh.
But even then, like...
Maybe, I mean, when was the whole court case with Lady Chatterley's lover? That must have been before then, or maybe not.
I don't know.
I suppose he was kind of quite, I don't know.
Risqué.
Yeah.
Figure.
I mean, quite maybe controversial he was just like the height himself. Of being very famous that you'd want to throw it in.
Yeah, I guess it was like a meeting of a controversial writer with a controversial suffragist.
Is there on one of these interviews where she like, was this what Di Atkinson said to us about her lighting up when she talks about setting fire to herself?
Oh, it's so brilliant.
Yeah.
I think she might have been like had a touch of the pyromaniac about her because she's so like, she really does light up when she talks about it and she's so cheeky with it as well. And I think she also really got a rush of like escaping from the police as well. Like,
as she would.
Like oh, yeah.
It sounds like a lot of the time she just kind of did a lot. She kind of tried to push it as far as she could.
Yeah.
Like, what can I get away with this time? Oh, I'm going to, like, ask this police to open my taxi door
for
me.
Well, it sounds like she's mocking them.
She totally is.
Yeah, definitely. But, yeah, in a good way.
She's just brilliant. I am so interested in everything that she did.
I don't know if she's in this... So that new Di Atkinson book, The Rise Up Women, there's a... I know I said about this before, but there's this amazing picture in it of a suffragettes in the 60s. And I think it was done for, like, The Observer. They got them back together, and there's Annie Kenney's sister is in it. But I can't find it online, but it's in the book, so
maybe we could put it on Instagram.
It's such an amazing book, because I think the fact of seeing these women in the 60s, where you think of quite a modern time period, and then looking at them, and like, I think it's Jessie Kenney, Annie Kenney, so it looks so much like Annie Kenney.
Mm.
And there's also this really cool, there's like two photos, and one of them is them more relaxed, and there's one of them that's got like a cigar, I think, that she's smoking.
Wait.
She's wearing like a Chanel like suit with a pillbox hat. I might be wrong, but she's definitely...
That's how I see myself as an older woman.
Yeah, but we can put some pictures up of Lily when she's an older woman, and she still looks so sassy. Like, I still always feel like she's got that twinkle behind her eyes.
Yeah, I can
fire behind her eyes.
Her eyes. Longing for the days. Good old days. Going back to Lady Chatterley's lover, she confessed during the interview that the only one of his books she had read since meeting him was Lady Chatterley's Lover, stating, "It must have been an expurgated version because I don't remember anything special about it."
Oh, maybe they parted on bad terms.
Maybe. In 1970, as treasurer of the Suffragette Fellowship, Lenton unveiled a memorial in Christchurch Garden, Westminster, dedicated to all the men and women who had braved derision, opposition and ostracism, many enduring physical violence and suffering to get women the vote.
Nice.
Lillian died in Twickenham on October the 28th, 1972, aged 81. A week later, her obituary in the Times described her as the tiny, wily, elusive Pimpernel.
Aww.
The end.
It does. Sorry, I'm just looking up Lady Chatterley's Lover, and it does say the court case was in 1960s.
So, so it was right at this time.
Yeah, which is like makes sense. I mean, it's such a famous thing to happen. So,
I'm just fascinated by this whole meeting. Why everyone mentions it, but nobody kind of explains too much about it. I think it must have just been like too controversial.
I think maybe. Well, it's weird that everyone brings it up. I can see why she would bring it up.
I would.
At that time,
yeah.
Absolutely.
I was just thinking, when you were saying about statues, the Millicent Fawcett statue's unveiled tomorrow, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, when we released this episode 2 days ago.
It will, yeah.
Or no, one day ago.
Yeah.
one day ago. Yesterday.
We had to go and see the unveiling.
No, which is really upsetting because, yeah, we're at work. But
it's the only female statue in Parliament Square, and it's also going to be the last statue to be put up in Parliament Square because there's no more room for
and
anymore.
And Hannah was involved with sorting out the costume for it.
Yeah, yes. I helped the...
Gillian Waring herself.
Gillian Waring, the sculptor, to get a historically accurate outfit. So that was awesome.
Forever for prosperity.
Yeah. So we'll definitely have to go and... Go check it out.
Yeah. Let's do it. We'll take a selfie.
Awesome. Great. Well, thanks for listening, guys. Again, we didn't write down.
We're just waiting.
I'm just looking at Amy because you're the best at.
So,
you can. Check out our Instagram, which is the.suffragette.city, and we'll put up photos to illustrate each episode, so definitely check that out.
And if you want to contact us about any feedback on our podcast, or if there's anything you want us to talk about, you can contact us on thesuffragettecity@gmail.com, and we will be looking at that and responding to your requests.
Eagerly awaiting. And,
please also do subscribe to this podcast, and also give us a review, because we love reading. We've had 3 reviews so far.
Yay!
And we love hearing your feedback,
and it really does help us out loads. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks for listening, guys, and tune in next time. Okay, bye.
Bye.
Bye.